So I'm excited to talk to you about some of the work that I've been doing in New York City, and I think it fits really nicely with the two presentations that we just had. And I'll try to move through quickly because I'm looking forward to your questions. I don't have any financial disclosures to make, and I think we've already had some introduction to what I might mean by a walkable built environment, and I'm really talking just about the urban form of the environment as being sort of densely built with a mixture of land uses, having homes near shops and restaurants, with well-connected street networks and with public transit access. And I will say that within the New York City environment, we've worked quite a bit with these variables and other things that might be related to sort of density, diversity, and street design. And we do find that population density is highly correlated with all of the other variables here. So when we've done principal component analysis, we really can't beat density as a predictor of walking. And it seems to make public transportation more feasible and support some of the economic activity. So I'm going to talk to you about density and land use mix and public transportation options, but I think it's worth keeping in mind that those are all highly correlated and really we see similar patterns because they're not independent. There's certainly been previous work, and I just said a couple of reviews here, and our work previously in New York City showing that this compact urban form or walkability is associated with more walking for transportation and with a lower body mass index. And the question that I wanted to address in this paper is how that relates to health disparities around obesity. And we know that obesity rates are highest for people of low socioeconomic status, Black race, and Hispanic ethnicity in this country, and might be concerned about that and interested in trying to ameliorate those disparities. And I was very interested in whether built environments and walkability might make sense as a strategy to address those disparities. So what do we already know about the relevance of walkability and of urban form for these population subgroups? Well, there have been a number of authors who have suggested, and this was my expectation as well, that groups that are disadvantaged with respect to their obesity risk and also their residential options would have a stronger sort of susceptibility to the immediate environment, that walkability would matter more because of having fewer transportation options and also fewer physical activity options other than walking. So you might have cost barriers to using a gym or golfing, whereas walking is much more attractive, and if you don't have a car to get out of your neighborhood, you're sort of stuck with the neighborhood streets which are already a common location for walking. But I've just completed a systematic review of the literature and what it says about the built environment and obesity-related health disparities and the role that might play. And I just want to point out a couple of examples where the evidence seems to point to less of a relationship between these urban form variables and either physical activity or BMI for the groups that we're interested in. And these studies that I'm citing are from very different locations around the country, so that the pattern might not be consistent and has been looked at sort of only sporadically. Within New York, we have a tremendous diversity in the population, so we wanted to look at each of these contrasts within a single population. So our research question was, we wanted to look at whether we could find support for the idea that disadvantaged groups are more vulnerable to the walkability of the immediate environment, to the urban form. So the expectation going in was that we would see a stronger walkability BMI association for these subgroups. Data we used came from the New York Cancer Cohort, which was designed as a longitudinal study, but I'm just going to talk about the baseline data here. The recruitment occurred in 2000 to 2002 and was designed to attract a diverse representative sample of the New York population. Although it was volunteer-based, the demographic composition actually compares pretty well to the rest of the city and to other random digit dial type of methods. We collected some survey measures, including home address, and we measured height and weight and used those to calculate BMI, or body mass index. So I want to orient you to the New York City environment, and on the left here, you can see the five boroughs. Most of what you might picture, if you're not familiar with the New York area, as typical New York, Wall Street, Central Park, is in the dark green area, which is Manhattan, but we do have actually a lot more diversity in the type of urban form because of including all five boroughs, Staten Island, Queens, the Bronx, and Brooklyn. Community districts are shown in the middle here, and these units are important because they do have names like Harlem, Mott Point, Upper East Side that have meaning to people, and they have community boards also that help to control some of the environment within those areas. And just for perspective, I've also shown census tracts, which are much smaller than these community districts. Our geographic data sources were the 2000 census, and from there we got information on population characteristics, population density, and also the use of public transit for commuting. Our land use mix data came from tax assessor's information, the Pluto data set in New York City. And we have some information that I'm actually not going to talk about for time on the locations of bus and subway stops, but those patterns are very similar to the public transit use patterns that we see, and those are all in the paper. Our definition of the environment around each home was relatively simple, a 1 kilometer airline buffer, so that's just a circle with a radius of 1 kilometer with the person's home right in the middle. We did a sensitivity analysis looking at smaller and larger buffer sizes, and in our other work we've looked at network buffers, census tracts, and a number of other operationalizations and not found our results to be very sensitive to that. Generalized estimating equations were used to give us marginal effect estimates while correcting our standard errors for the fact that people are clustered within these community districts. We controlled for individual and neighborhood characteristics, including individual age, gender, education, and race and ethnicity. And in order to get at the question of interest, we stratified by individual and neighborhood measures of disadvantage, and we created these dichotomizations a priori with basically an attempt to put about a quarter of our population in the disadvantaged group, and so for the neighborhood disadvantage measures, we explicitly used quartiles, and for the individual characteristics, we had categorical measures, like category of educational attainment, and so we designed that to be about a quarter in the disadvantaged category, which, because we had a sample of about 13,000 adults, we actually would still have several thousand, even in our smallest strata. We had good geographic representation of the city, and I just want to mention that the age was about 46 on average, and that over half of our sample was overweight or obese. So. With this same cohort, we've previously looked at population density, land use mix, and access to public transit as predictors of BMI and found those to be significant. And I don't have connectivity because we haven't found that to vary a lot within the New York environment, and it's highly correlated with density. So we've sort of ignored that in this analysis, and it wasn't related to BMI in our previous work. But that previous work has been replicated in an independent sample of 10,000 New Yorkers. So I'm going to spend a little time on our first measure, and then the other tables will be similar. Population density was an average of about 10,000, 15,000 people per square kilometer. And so the point of looking at this is just to be able to see the interquartile range there, and then also the numbers and how that range of variation compares across our subgroups. So we had, these were our individual definitions of disadvantage, less than a high school education, less than or equal to a high school education, less than or equal to $30,000 per year of household income, black race, Hispanic ethnicity, and we compared those to a category of none of the above. So the thing to look at here is on the right side, we do have a range within each of the subgroups that is sort of overlapping. So we do have some ability to look at variation within the subgroups. And that's true for land use mix and also for public transit use. And one of the special things about working within the New York City environment is that public transit use is very common and that people don't have the same access to vehicles that they do in other parts of the country, so that people really are out experiencing their environments, and so we might expect that these associations are actually stronger within New York City than elsewhere. So for population density, this is just our previously published estimate that as population density increases, BMI goes down. This is the expected direction of association. And I'm showing here in blue the college-educated, higher-income, non-Hispanic whites, which are sort of our advantaged subgroup that doesn't fall into any of our categories of disadvantage. And so that's the group to keep an eye on in comparison to the others. That's also interesting. It's the group that's been most studied in this literature. So if you look at any of the categories of disadvantage, we have basically no association. Any slope is slightly upwards. So this is for population density with individual disadvantage strata. This is using instead neighborhood disadvantage. And again, these were, a priori, we just did a quartile cut point. So we really only see this walkability, or this population density BMI association within our advantage subgroup. And then if we look across, these are three different indicators. Again, they're correlated, but we looked at five in the paper, which is IMPRESS at AJPH. And we see, again, that we have a significant interaction. The blue line, which is our advantage group, has the strongest downward slope. These first ones are just stratified by individual disadvantage, like the ones I first showed. This is by area level disadvantage. And it's a pretty remarkably consistent association. Again, we can look also at subways and buses, and that pattern holds. We looked at this pattern within men and women in our sample and saw a similar pattern, although some of the confidence intervals start getting wide. And we looked with different buffer sizes, the same pattern held. So it seems to be pretty robust and was pretty surprising to us, really. I mean, we went in thinking, oh, well, we'll look at this expectation, and it made sense to our team, so I think we must be learning if we're surprising ourselves. But this pattern sort of needs to be explained and needs to be reconciled with our interest in decreasing health disparities by addressing the barriers within the built environment. So it's possible that we might have found even that the effects were the same for all of our groups, and my conclusion or my takeaway message was that in fact it was less relevant. These walkability indicators were less relevant for our disadvantaged groups. So before we get into explanations, I think it's important to keep in mind the limitations of the study, which, like much of the work in this area, is cross-sectional and observational. These are relatively simple, although very commonly used, measures of the environment. Our group does have some more detailed measures, and I wish I could tell you that we found something that works a lot better. We're trying to get better safety measures, although we do have very detailed traffic safety measures of where pedestrians have been hit by cars. And so we have another analysis where we're trying to explain this by using more detailed measures of the environment. also this is using BMI, which, while it's certainly relevant for public health and for our interest in this association, it's not saying that walking for transportation is unrelated to these urban form characteristics, just that we're not getting the BMI effect that we would expect. On the other hand, we have a number of strengths. We have our large N and our diverse sample, which gives us a lot of statistical power to look within these subgroups, and that we use BMI and the GIS measures of the environment does at least give us independent observations of the exposure and outcome, which addresses some potential biases, although of course that's limited as well. So I'm going to run briefly through the explanations that we've mostly focused on, and I would be really interested in your thoughts as well. So our first response to this was that maybe we're getting this pattern because these are the wrong measures of the environment for this group, that maybe we need to measure safety, maybe we need to measure something about the aesthetics, the physical disorder. And so we're working on that and we're exploring that. I also think it could be an issue of what I would call overdetermination, that if you're in a neighborhood that is unsafe and you have physical limitations, you have time limitations because of childcare obligations and work responsibilities, you might not be able to respond to the attractiveness of your environment by walking or more or less. On the other extreme, within the context of New York especially, people frequently don't have cars and may be stuck walking even in an area that they find unattractive or unsafe. So that would be what I call the captive walkers hypothesis for this. Finally, one thing that I think is maybe concerning or intriguing is that if we take seriously the criticism of this literature that it's self-selection, that people who want to walk move into walkable neighborhoods, and people who don't care about it end up in the other types of neighborhoods, you might expect that advantage groups have more options to select into neighborhoods that match their preferences. And that could also be an explanation for this pattern, which would be a non-causal explanation, but would basically be supporting a selection hypothesis. So I look forward to your comments. Thank you.
We have several minutes left for questions. Thank you. Good job. So please stand up. Someone that hasn't asked a question, maybe. Come on, stand up way in the back. We can't hear you.
That is something I actually presented at the poster session this morning, and it's been submitted but not published yet. I've submitted it for the Epidemiology Review Special Issue on Disparities.
Stand up, please.
I will, if I could just respond to that for one moment. We do have within the New York environment another paper that's actually in press at the Environmental Health Perspectives Journal looking at the food environment, and certainly I don't mean to ignore that. I'm just trying to find one nugget to focus on. So we have some work looking at what matters within the environment, and there are some idiosyncrasies of the New York City environment where national fast food chains are less prominent than local fast food chains, but I appreciate the comment.
Stand up, please.
We learned from Montreal public gathering. We did a study on the accessibility of fast food, and maybe it's high for both weekend in downtown Montreal, where the cold is state. And I'm sure that the main codes that be a high.
A couple more questions. Way in the back, and then here, and then we'll move on.
Thanks.
little bit of irony there, isn't it, that after you've died, you're still offering a protective effect. Question.
Thank you.
Alberto Ortega from UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And I was wondering whether you look at disadvantaged people in advantaged neighborhoods and vice versa. Because it might be that disadvantaged individuals have a specific neighborhood around them that is also disadvantaged, and that advantaged individuals live in advantaged neighborhoods. Densities in New York, places like New York City, are pretty dense anywhere we go. So it might be that those areas are characterized by very different factors than the areas where the other individuals play, even if both areas are very dense.
Sure. Briefly, certainly the individual and neighborhood disadvantage stratifications that we looked at are quite strongly overlapping, and I wouldn't say that those are independent of each other. They're just sort of looking at it two different ways. And the off diagonals, the sort of people who are in a more advantaged or disadvantaged area than you would expect by their individual characteristics, would be really interesting, and I think we should spend more time on those, but we haven't looked at that.
Suggest that maybe we move on to the next presentation, the last presentation, and then we'll have some time left over. So it was a wonderful session so far. Let's keep on going. Thank you. Do components of the built food environment influence body mass index, BMI, of residents? Jennifer Gregson. Jennifer?
Hi, thank you very much. Actually, I'm really glad to be following Gina,